You're listening to the Cash and Burn podcast, and I'm your host, Brandon Metcalf. Join me as I interview and have conversations with founders and leaders about the greatest obstacles and challenges they've faced while building their businesses. Learn how they overcame them and ultimately what made them successful. The podcast is brought to you by Place. Place is a B2B SaaS customer subscription management, billing, forecasting, and metrics platform powered by Salesforce. Growing SaaS businesses use Place to better align their revenue and finance teams so they can boost revenue growth and retention, manage renewals, collect cash faster, and make more informed decisions all directly inside of Salesforce. Hey everyone, welcome back to Cash and Burn. This week I have Sean Olds, the co-founder and CEO of Boodle AI. Hey Sean.
Hey Brandon, thanks for having me today. Good to be here.
I'm excited to have you on. On our prep call, I was listening to some of your stories, and I'm excited for you to share them with the audience. But why don't we level set? Give the audience a piece of like who you are, what your background is, and then we'll go from there.
Sure. Name Sean Olds. I started my career at the U.S. Military Academy, West Point. I was a computer science major there, and although I'm running a tech company, I did not code our tech stack. The languages I programmed in back there, they now teach in the history of computers class. But graduated, had all the plans to go from platoon leader to chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and unfortunately jumped out of a plane made by the lowest bidder with a parachute made by the lowest bidder, and the two did not work out so well for me. So I sustained a broken back on one of my last jumps and was medicaled out of the military. And really kind of at a loss for what to do because I'd always planned on staying in for a career. Got very fortunate. This was the late 90s and the dot-com boom was just starting. And I ended up with a consulting firm that was very well established in the logistics space. And this was when all the e-commerce companies were coming along and they needed logistics help. I literally was the only computer science major in this company. And so as they were pitching their opportunity to one of the startups, they pitched me as their computer science major. And so I got the taste for startups and the bug for startups, and pretty much for 20 plus years have continued to either build companies, invest in companies. I took a little bit of a respite after September 11th. And with the events there, I got recruited back into government service and did counterterrorism work for the government, mostly in Southwest Asia and Africa. But then came back from that, went to grad school, and went initially into consulting, got married, and wife wanted a little bit more stable structure for the family. And then I got recruited to an opportunity I've often jokingly said is my most well-funded startup. One of the sovereign wealth funds in Abu Dhabi recruited a group of 12 of us to build the first global Arab energy company. And wow. So moved over to the Middle East. Ended up spending a total of 8 years between the Middle East and Africa, and was about to head to Singapore, actually, to work on the venture arm of a family office down there. And my now co-founder, who I met in the U.S. Army Ranger School, we'd stayed friends over the years, pitched me on the idea of Boodle. And the genesis of Boodle, in addition to everything I've done professionally, I have spent 20 plus years serving on nonprofit boards. I went on my first nonprofit board the week after I graduated West Point, focused on youth education. Always been very passionate about youth education. After the military, did several veteran service boards. And so have jokingly said that the genesis of Boodle is that my co-founder and I are basically lazy. We got tired of beating our heads against the wall trying to raise money for nonprofits and wanted to find a way to bring technology, specifically data science and machine learning, to nonprofits. And that's what we did. And that led to also then going into sales and marketing teams as well.
So what exactly do you guys do at Boodle? Like, what's the company do?
Yep. So Boodle, it's going through an evolution, actually. So we started out as a predictive analytics firm, helping both nonprofits and sales teams find their best donors and their best customers, both through prospect prioritization, as well as finding net new donors and building new lists for them. With the advent of generative AI, we realize that there's a more efficient way to do it. And so we are actually transitioning the platform to be able to do everything it used to do, but now through a generative interface. But doing more than that, rather than just providing one generative interface for what we do, providing basically an ecosystem where multiple AIs can talk together and work amongst themselves. So people today right now may have a ChatGPT window open and a Midjourney window open and a Stable Diffusion window open, and they don't talk to each other. And that's not how we work. We're collaborative people. Humans are collaborative people. And so what we've done is create through Boodlebox an ecosystem where all of those AIs can talk in one context window and they can work together to solve an organization's issues.
Interesting. So if I got this right, so then you're helping like nonprofits find like who should be donating, contributing and all of that. Immediately when you were talking, I'm like, have you guys done very much with like Salesforce.org and then the nonprofit arm of Salesforce?
Yep. So there's a lot of work going on. Actually, there's a new organization called Fundraising AI, which is in itself a nonprofit that is really focused on the ethical use of AI in the nonprofit community. And Salesforce has been a big standard bearer in that. Boodle AI has been strong in that, as have about right now, I think we're up to over 40 organizations.
Wow.
That have signed and endorsed a framework for AI in the nonprofit space.
That's awesome. I mean, there's definitely a need. I mean, we've done in my consulting firm, we've done various different like CRM setups and things like that. We always get to learn. Like, I've been on a nonprofit board, but I've never like run a nonprofit to understand what it's actually like to like raise the money and all of that. Although I'm very used to raising money on the software side. But there's definitely a need to organize that and make it much more efficient and effective. So that's cool. It's exciting what you guys are doing in leveraging AI. And I know I have some questions for you in a bit about AI, but you know, the theme of the show is I always like to talk about challenges and setbacks and what you've overcome. And, you know, just from talking with you, not only now, but also in the pre-show, like you've overcome some things and done some amazing things that I think the audience would really love to hear about. So what comes to mind when I bring up like what challenges and obstacles have you overcome?
Sure. I mean, the biggest challenge I alluded to a little bit earlier was Ranger school. I mean, I that was part of, I grew up to a dad who was an Army Ranger, was super excited to go to Ranger school. Everything in life though, we as humans, like we achieve something, we do something and it's kind of like, it's done. What's the next thing? The one challenge and obstacle in life I could have never prepared for was the accident I had. You know, I struggled with the fact that I was still alive and I was very fortunate to be alive, but I was alive in a body that couldn't go forward and be in the military anymore and couldn't do what I had spent the 20 plus years to that point training and being ready to do. And so that definitely caused a lot of internal consternation and a lot of soul searching and trying to figure out what was next. As I mentioned, I was fortunate in that I kind of fell into a consulting job that was in a firm that was trying to move into that next step in technology, which was the dot-com boom. And trying to leverage what they knew 30 years of logistics and supply chain and bring it into this new era of technology and e-commerce. And I was very fortunate to right place, right time. And you look at a lot of people who have been fortunate in life, successful in life, it's timing. And that timing allowed me to go into an organization. And what was great is it wasn't my startup, right? I didn't have all of my money in it. I didn't have my parents' money in it. I didn't have all my friends and family money in it. And having done that later on in life, that's an extremely stressful way to approach running a business. I was able to take a much more holistic view, watching on the sidelines and adding value, but knowing at the end of the day, like my risk in that business was not what everybody else's was. And so you get to watch people make very bad decisions. You get to watch people make actually some very good decisions. And I've always said in the military, some of my best leaders were some of my worst leaders. Because you watch them make really bad mistakes and you tell yourself, I will never do that to the people I lead. At the same time, I was fortunate to see some people who did some amazing things while the company was going forward. Unfortunately, the bad outweighed the good. I joined them pre-A round, went through A round, B round, C round, IPO, $8 billion valuation, debt spiral, bankruptcy. And I think the hardest part of the experience was I worked with the technology team. It was not the technology. And in fact, we found out years later that Bezos and Amazon actually tried to buy the technology out of bankruptcy because at the time they saw it as the only technology that rivaled them. And that made it even more frustrating that This amazing technology, this amazing team actually got mired by the lack of financial structure in the company.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, like back the dot-com boom and bust was like, you guys weren't the only company that experienced this. But I mean, what do you think really was the downfall? Like, how did it boom and then all of a sudden bankrupt?
It was a couple. I mean, there were many attributing factors. I wouldn't even put it at a couple. The biggest at the end of the day was how the CFO's team or the finance team built their financing. And they did something that many companies do, and they get kind of, oh, we're going from 1 billion to 5 billion to 20 billion. We don't have to worry about all this other stuff. And they gloss over a lot of things, but there were also just some silly mistakes made. You would have an HR team that needed to prove and justify why they were there. And I watched people get hired to do a job. They would finish after 6 months. And rather than repurpose that person, they were hiring someone in who to do that person's job again. And all of a sudden you'd get people who were bored. I mean, we were eToys. It had toys all around it, right? We had games. I literally watched people come into work for 3 months and just play video games until they got so bored they went and looked for another job because no one would repurpose them. And you know, that's a horrible and inefficient way to spend venture capital money. Not quite as bad as throwing huge parties and wasting a bunch of money on parties, but pretty close to it. And we had the masseuse tables, we had the, you know, free food and everything else. So I think there were a multitude of factors. In that business's case, though, it really at the end of the day was around financial structuring that really drove it down.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing some of that now, right? Where, you know, I think a lot of companies went down a debt route when the economic climate started to tighten up. And I think now we're going to see some companies really try to survive higher interest rates for longer periods of time because money's just not free anymore. So the rest of this year should be a bit of a wild ride. I think it's also seeing, you know, other companies are starting to get through it. Like I've definitely felt it at my companies that the market's improving. Like tech companies are starting to spend some money again. They're being much more disciplined, I think, about what they're spending money on, but it's definitely moving. But, you know, high interest rates and a lot of debt is something that we'll see if people recover from. And also, you know, the mindset of always being able to raise more money, I think that mindset has finally shifted as well. And it goes to what you were saying is like, hey, it's venture capital money. Let's go spend and let's make the employees happy and let's have the best culture and all of that. At the end of the day, that's all amazing. But if you're not figuring out how you're actually going to generate money to fund your own business, then you're going to be in a world of hurt. So very symbolic of where we're at now. So, all right. So the other thing that when you were talking before, when you were talking about, you know, timing, you know, what I gather from you and also my own background, timing plays a part of it, but I think there's another big thing that plays a part of it, which is perseverance. And sticking through it and pushing through and getting through the big challenges that you have, because I see a lot of people that just give up and like, I'm going to pivot. Like I was talking with our head of sales at Place and some of our frustration with some of the people that join us and then stick around for a year and go somewhere else. And it's like, I have an adverse reaction. I'm like, why are you only staying at one company for a year? And you're like doing this over and over and over and over again versus sticking with something and figuring out how you grow in that organization. And part of me is like, am I old? And that's just like an outdated way of thinking. But I just think you learn so much when you stick through and get through like times that you don't love and figure out how to, like you're saying, being repurposed. But you know, asking, can I go do this? Can I tackle this? I want to learn this. Show me this. It's the whole point of being at a startup. So after eToys, then what happened? So I'm fascinated by this Middle East energy company because it's
I did a couple of startups. And then, as I mentioned, September 11th happened and I went back into government service, came back, went to grad school and got married at a grad school. And my wife made me swear off startups at that point. She's, you want to be an angel investor, that's fine, but we need good, steady income. And so went into consulting and within 2 years got recruited by one of the sovereign wealth funds in the Middle East, which did something that was very novel. So most sovereign wealth funds invest money like a private equity firm. They take a 10 to 30% stake. They sit on the board. They financially manage the organization and then they flip it. This particular sovereign wealth fund wanted to build the first ever global Arab energy company. And so their only restriction was we weren't allowed to buy Middle Eastern assets. We had to look outside of the Middle East. And so we, and then what we had to do was look at upstream oil and gas, midstream pipeline and storage, and downstream power generation. And then the initial group of people that were all hired, we were all in an M&A role, but also then had corporate roles, because we weren't just acquiring a 10 to 30% stake. We were acquiring the entire asset and then putting them back into the parent corporation back in Abu Dhabi. And so I was recruited because of my supply chain background to be the chief procurement officer. And so my wife was happy with that as a startup, because it wasn't a startup that was ill-funded. There was a lot of good job security, and went over there, and it was a blast. My first year, I did 300,000 airline miles, 275 nights in hotel rooms, I think 14 different countries we were working in and doing acquisitions in. And it was just immense. And it moved like a startup. We could make decisions in weeks. The biggest challenge we ran into, which is what a lot of companies run into as they grow, is we quit innovating and we started to behave like a big company. And so all of a sudden, 3 years later, decisions we used to make in a week would take an entire quarter, because we had to have a meeting to prep for the meeting, to prep for the PowerPoint presentation that was then going to be delivered to the board. And by then you could lose deals in that time period and lose opportunities. And so that for me just was not as much fun. I enjoy more of the quick innovative cycles. And that's why when my co-founder approached me about starting Boodle, it was a very attractive opportunity. Not as much to my wife. She wasn't as excited to see another startup, but we have continued to innovate. We're still a small firm. We're under 20 people. But we continue to innovate. And to me, that's what makes it exciting.
Yeah. And then how did you so you started off doing predictive, and now are you still doing predictive and you added generative, or are you just focused on generative now?
So we took everything we had done before, and what we're doing is we're putting it into this new generative space. And so, and it was an evolution. We actually, when we made the shift, our initial kind of evolution was just to build a Boodle GPT. And to build a middle layer AI company that was the best at understanding, we had 35 billion proprietary insights on how people consume and how they donate. And so being the best middle layer AI company for sales teams and for fundraising teams. And what we found as we launched the alpha of that earlier this year is that people really don't care about how powerful an underlying large language model is. What they care about is, did I get what I needed? And so what we realized is we were kind of limiting ourselves by just having our Boodle GPT. We needed it to be able to interact with other AIs. Hmm. And so now what we're building out, putting out into the market is what we call Boodle Box, which is a single UI that people can come to, but they can now pull in ChatGPT or Bard or Claude if they want to, and they can marry that with Midjourney, and they can bring in their documents, and they can bring in their structured data about their customers, and they can bring in Boodle GPT all in the same conversation to help them understand how they're going to find that next customer or how to steward that donor along and keep them.
And then, so you've been doing this for, did you say 7 years?
7 years we started, yes.
So launching an AI company, like one of the, from my understanding, and I don't have an AI company, but from my understanding, it's the amount of data, the amount of transactions, the amount of learning that you go through. So after 7 years, are you guys just going to market and you've been building the whole time, or what's it been like?
Yeah, no, we spent the first 4 years just building. We didn't want to build the car as it was rolling down the road. And so we spent the first 4 years and then we went to market. In our first year, we were really limited to what I would call prospect prioritization. So organization has a certain type of donor or customer they want more of. We built the ability to build automated models so that you don't need teams of data scientists to do it. It's all done by the machine. And then take that model and apply it to a prospect list or new customers, or so that you could target how you were reaching out to people and not just spamming every new customer with the same offer. What evolved the second year was we realized in building a proprietary database of all 250 million Americans, we could actually take that model and apply it to our list and build net new list of people that are bespoke. What organizations have typically done when they want to go buy new donors or new customers is they walk into a list provider with 20 demographic categories, they buy 100,000 names, and they start to walk out proudly and realize there's 1,000 companies behind them with the same 20 demographic categories about to buy the same 100,000 names. But because we're building a model with their customer set or with their donor set, when they apply it to our database, they're getting a completely unique list. And so we finished with that at the end of last year. And as we got into this year, looking at why weren't we scaling as quickly as we wanted to, the big problem we were running into is AI is hard. It's not easy, no matter how easy we made it in the UI. And so if a sales director or development director walked in the morning with a question and they looked at our UI and they couldn't answer it, they couldn't build the bridge from their question to our UI, our software was useless. And what we realized with generative AI is I no longer need them to build the bridge. I need them to take their question and put it on the keyboard and then let generative AI dig into our 35 billion insights or the other AIs we have available and answer that question for them and bring it back.
Interesting. So what do you think is the hardest part that you've had to overcome or figure out with Boodle?
I mean, it's always product market fit. I mean, with any new startup, and especially in the software space, it's finding that product market fit. And that's why I said one of our biggest problems on product market fit was people would look at our UI, but they couldn't bridge from their question. We were never going to get real product market fit at scale. We had great adoption once a person who was a more tech forward person was using our legacy platform.
Yeah.
But that's not the majority of people who are going to be using our platform.
Any tricks or techniques that you've used to figure out product market fit?
There's a laundry list you could go through. But I mean, a lot of it is just listening. I mean, we constantly listen to, and not just friends and family, because friends and family are always going to tell you your unibrow baby looks beautiful. And so we go out and try to tell the people who are going to tell us our baby's got a unibrow. But then we'll tell us, hey, here's how I saw a friend of mine fix their unibrow baby. Here's the things you can do. And that's what we look for, is that active feedback in how can we make this better for our ideal customer?
Yeah, man. I mean, I think your experience is so similar to mine. So with Place, we've been trying to figure out product market fit for 3.5-4 years now. Well, probably more like 3 years, where we started off doing financial forecasting and planning inside of Salesforce, and realized that most Salesforce users are not finance people, and most finance people don't want to be inside of Salesforce. But we knew the vision for what we were trying to deliver was like, how do we create financial transparency across an organization and give, you know, the teams that really need that financial transparency access to it? So like, how do I give sales and revenue producing teams real information about their clients and their past due bills and or the current bills and all of that? And how do we connect those dots? And I did a similar thing where, like, I'm using this product. I love this product. It's got some warts on it. We're fixing the warts, but it does what we say it's going to do. And I went through this journey of, I'm just going to talk to people. I'm going to talk to, you know, customers who bought. Great. What else can we do? Like, how are you using it? Can we get some insight of things that you're doing that we didn't even think of? But I spent a lot of time talking to prospects who didn't buy, because we had this trend, which was just glaring product market fit issue. We had a trend where 50% of everyone who didn't buy our product bought nothing else. So we were just wasting time educating a market of, hey, there's a different way of doing this without understanding really what the market wanted. And it was through all of those interviews of like, spend some time with me. And all these prospects, like, I thought I was going to get more no's. We don't want to talk to you. We're not interested, or ghosting me. Most of the people I reached out to, they're like, yeah, we're happy to help out, because they liked our team and they liked how we treated them during the process. And they gave me a lot of insight. And I approached it with the mindset of, like, I'm not trying to sell you. Like, that's not the point of this call. I just want to learn. And that changed everything for us, where we realized, yeah, forecasting is interesting, but it's not really the pain that companies want to solve. And what companies want us to solve is, how do I take a deal from like being in a pipeline to winning the deal and converting that into revenue and revenue recognition to billing it, to then forecasting it, collecting cash and coming back and doing all of those things that we do now, and doing it all inside of Salesforce? Because what people started to tell us, they're like, your thought process of why you want to do all this in Salesforce is what we want you to solve. The way you're solving it is not what we want. And if it wasn't for like what you were saying as well, as far as talking to people, we would have never pieced that together. And, you know, I think that's one of the biggest reasons. Like, everyone says startups fail because of cash. Well, yeah, no shit. But they fail because they're not getting cash from customers, because they're not solving the real need. So I think for me, solving product market fit is exactly that. Just talk to people and don't have an ego. Let them tell you have a unibrow baby.
let them tell you of a unibrow baby. And more than anything, my favorite part of being an entrepreneur in a business is when your clients teach you how to use your platform.
Yeah.
You know, you don't, and a lot of entrepreneurs are like, no, you got to use it this way. This is the way I envisioned it. And they're like, no, let people do what they want with it. And if they'll adopt it in a different way, God bless them. Let them go.
That's so true. And it's so important. Like the ego there of like, it's my baby and I don't want it to like, no, like it needs to go out. It needs to break bones. It needs to trip and fall. It needs to do all the stuff. So it turns into an adult and, you know, you ultimately get the return you're, we're all hoping always to get. So, well, I have a specific question for you. Like one that I always ask on the show is like, what do you think founders or execs right now, what should everyone be focused on?
Running an AI company, but I do think it's AI, but I would say larger, it's technology. And I gave this example. I learned this early in my career. You know, I watched a 30-year-old, very old, stodgy consulting firm realize they would go out of business if they didn't adopt and look at how what they could apply what they did for new technology. And they actually ended up doing exceedingly well because they were one of the first firms to do that in the logistics space. And these e-commerce companies needed help on that. In the 90s, the e-commerce companies were all focused on the technology, not on how I actually deliver what I need to deliver. And so through my career, I've always watched the most successful companies I've invested in, the most successful companies I've worked with, is they're always looking at what's that next technology. I mean, it was a big step for us to go back to our investors at the beginning of this year and tell them we are sunsetting our legacy platform. We're going to pull everything we've built. We're going to use everything we've built. But the way we used to go to market and what we used to offer, it's not going to work in the future, not with the advent of generative AI. And I honestly think we're not far away from individual walks in out of their MBA into, call it Under Armour, and they're going to get their parking pass, the key to their office, and their access to their Under Armour, you know, GPT. And they're going to log in, and in the morning, it's going to help them do their 401k, their payroll, all the stuff that an HR rep doesn't want to sit down and do for the 100th time. They're going to be able to do it all right there. And then they're going to go to lunch with their new sales team. And then in the afternoon, they're going to walk in and they're going to find out what was the lowest selling SKU last year. How many customers did we have on it? How many of those were repeat customers? What's the profile of those customers? And what's the best way to appeal to those customers in a campaign? Something that would typically take someone probably a month to find out that Jane knows this and Bob knows this and Rick knows this and gather all that information and put it together, they'll be able to put an entire campaign on their first day on the job together if they wanted to. And that's all because of the power of having an enterprise generative AI available to them.
Yeah, I mean, it's exciting. I mean, the hype is, you know, hype is hype, and we're going to see what shakes out and what's a real product versus what's not a real product. Sort of like the dot-com boom, right? Like it's, but if this is used correctly, like it can solve true challenges that we have with wasting time on things that are just administrative and getting people back engaged with other people doing things that can move the business forward versus just checking boxes. And, you know, we're working on a lot of stuff with it for my staffing software. So like, how do we automate a lot of the stuff? How do we create efficiency so that you can focus on, you know, actually talking to candidates and actually talking to clients and have the system help you figure out who you should be talking to, when you should be talking to them, and then streamlining the whole process. A lot of what I'm hearing from other CEOs right now is to have a game plan for AI. When I say that to you, like a CEO should have a game plan for AI, what comes to mind for you? Like what would be a game plan for AI for a CEO?
I think, again, you need to look at your business because every game plan is going to be unique to what your offering is. But I think they need to look at AI beyond just the revenue numbers. You know, we started in the nonprofit space and a lot of people wanted to focus AI just on how it helped them raise money because that's where people focus when it comes to nonprofits. The reality is AI is being used in a variety of programmatic ways. The United Refugees Organization used to send people out with these big books of pictures. They'd send a dozen people out for a month to a refugee camp, thumbing through it, trying to make identities. Now they use two people in about 3 days with a branch of AI known as facial recognition, and they go out with an iPad and they just scan people. And now they're doing hundreds of matches. Wow. So think about how much more effective those dollars that they raise are because of how they're applying AI programmatically. And so when I think of a game plan, I think of a game plan holistically across the business, not just focused on how is this going to drive more sales, but what does this do to help my employees? How does this help my customer success team not answer the same question 100 times in a day? How does this help my HR team not have to sit down with every new employee when they could be focusing on bigger things related to HR around the company? So I was at a conference last week speaking, and I started it by saying, I'm here, you know, to address the concern that AI is coming for your jobs. I'm going to tell you it's absolutely coming for your jobs, but just the boring parts, just the parts you don't like doing so that you can focus on the things you're really good at and that you enjoy doing.
Yeah, it's also going to lead to like a lot of reskilling and figuring out other jobs. And that's been coming for a while. And hopefully AI can help you reskill in a lot of those areas as well. So it's advantageous in that. So, well, Sean, I told you this was going to go by fast. We're already at time.
It's been a wonderful time. It flew by.
Yeah, thanks for coming on and sharing your stories. I'm excited to see what you guys will do at Boodle. It sounds like you're onto something pretty innovative. And knowing your background, you're going to persevere and be successful with whatever it is. So it's going to be excited to see where you go.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I've got a great team behind me, so I'm fortunate.
Awesome. Well, everyone else, Cash and Burn comes out every Tuesday. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.